Thank you, David. David was not introducing our next speaker. He's coming closer to the end of the evening. Our next speaker is a leader of that pillar of the anti-globalization movement, Friends of the Earth. Michelle Chan Fischel coordinates Friends of the Earth's Green Investments Project, which focuses on bringing environmental advocacy right to the other center of power, to Wall Street. She has published numerous pieces on this. She speaks about it. She organizes around it. She's written a terrific pamphlet that's perfect for organizers called The Anatomy of a Deal. Please welcome Michelle Chan Fischel.
Thanks, David. In 1995, the Wall Street Journal said something quite interesting. It said, big banks and mutual funds have taken over the role of quasi-public institutions like the World Bank and IMF. And at that time, private capital had outstripped public capital flows by a magnitude of 5 to 1. This year, in the year 2000, the Institute for International Finance forecasts that public funds going to the quote-unquote emerging markets, and these are the countries that are receiving some interest from Wall Street, we're not talking about sub-Saharan Africa and other countries which are considered very highly indebted and poor countries. The Institute for International Finance forecasts that emerging market public funds will amount to about $9 billion. But in the private sector, in the realm of Wall Street, mutual funds, pension funds, institutional investors, $193 billion will be going to the emerging markets. So as we look at this global casino economy, we can say in a certain sense that the era of World Bank-driven international development has passed us. And instead, we are facing a world of profit-driven development. In this world post-World Bank era, years and years of structural adjustment programs have set the stage where corporations and Wall Street are increasingly determining the development paths of entire countries. The structures have been adjusted. Environmental protections have been cut. Social safety nets have been rent apart. And the doors have been thrown open wide to trade and to multinational corporations and to Wall Street investors. In a world of big bank bailouts, and in a world where the IMF does not allow countries to institute capital controls, structural adjustment and years of austerity programs have not led to a decrease in poverty. Instead, it has created a world that is safe for Goldman Sachs. So what does this mean for activists, for campaigners, both on the community and the national and international level? When we deal with the privatization, so to speak, of international finance, of profit-driven finance, we're looking at a very different landscape than when we're dealing with World Bank advocacy. The magnitude and decentralization of capital in the private arena presents staggering campaign and advocacy and tactical challenges. For example, 20 years ago, when you had a really destructive, socially destructive, environmentally destructive hydropower project in a developing country, for example, that was displacing indigenous peoples, and it was inundating hectares and hectares of farmland, the World Bank usually would be the one that would be footing the bill for that, would be hiring all the engineers. And after years and years of advocacy, NGOs and activists could go and knock on the World Bank's door and say, hey, look, you are a taxpayer-funded institution. You've got to meet with these indigenous peoples, and you could try to improve the project. These days, a large hydropower dam with the same environmental and social effects may not be just funded by one monolithic institution. It may be Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Dean Witter, and Merrill Lynch all getting together to underwrite a bond in the United States, in the UK, in the Hong Kong capital markets, bought by hundreds and hundreds of investors. So what do you do then when you have a group of indigenous peoples that you're trying to be able to assist and have their voices heard? Who can you go to and knock on their door? It's not going to be one institution anymore. So the magnitude and decentralization of private capital really presents some critical strategic challenges for campaigners in this realm of Wall Street-driven development. Secondly, another problem is the responsibility vacuum that we face with Wall Street-driven development. At least with the World Bank, we can say that it has a poverty alleviation mission. You can say to the World Bank that you're supposed to be promoting the public good. You're supposed to be raising income levels. You're supposed to be protecting the environment. But when it comes to Wall Street, you cannot possibly say to Merrill Lynch, look, you guys are supposed to be protecting the poor, because they're not supposed to be. Similarly, when we deal with the World Bank, we can say, you are a taxpayer-funded institution. You're a public institution. We can hold you accountable. We can go to Congress. We can try to cut your money. We can meet with the Treasury Department. We can try to put pressure on you. We can do all of these things that we have legitimacy in doing because it's a public institution. We are taxpayer-funded. They are taxpayer-funded. But it's not the same with the Morgan Stanley Dean Witters of this world. Finally, the profit-driven mentality of Wall Street presents a third challenge to those of us that are trying to deal with how to improve accountability in this global financial casino. In the public policy realm, social justice issues are legitimate. But in the realm of Wall Street, cutting corners on environmental protection, busting unions, suppressing local opposition, sometimes makes the bottom line a lot fatter. So how can we start to deal with the global financial casino and with the Wall Streets of the world? We can start by trying to change some of the rules of the game and to also use the rules of the game to our advantage. And I'll go through a couple of examples. An idea to change the rules of the game is to shift economic incentives, those incentives that make it cheap to do bad things and expensive to do good things. We must stop a system where economic incentives allow the benefits of investment to be privatized, but the costs to be socialized. We can start by looking at tax shifting. We can start by looking at the federal appropriations process and the numerous environmentally harmful spending and subsidies that we as taxpayers are bankrolling every year. When we look at the World Bank and its funding of multinational corporations, if the IFC, if the International Finance Corporation, the private sector lending arm of the World Bank, is going to give money to any corporation, it better not be ExxonMobil. It better be small and medium enterprises based in developing countries. Another idea to change the rules of the game is to get into the securities laws of the United States. An idea would be to require every company that either wanted to sell stock and raise money in the United States or to trade stock in the United States to tell more about their environmental and labor stories, right in the financial statements that are audited and that have robust accounting methodologies to make sure that when an investor opens up a financial report and takes a look at a company, they also get the full rap sheet as well. We can also try to work within the rules of the game and use those rules to our advantage. I encourage all of you that are involved in social movements and who are activists on a personal level to make more alliances with the natural allies on Wall Street, which would be the socially responsible investing community. They have many tools that they've been developing and using to hold corporations accountable and to give a conscience to Wall Street. For example, some tools are to proactively invest in environmental technology companies, for example, or community development financial institutions. You can also avoid investing in egregious companies and voice your dissent and dissatisfaction with corporate irresponsibility by voting with your feet, by divesting. You can also claim your power as shareholders in companies and push for more corporate responsibility. Shareholder activism, as this is called, has called for an end to sweatshop working conditions. It has called for more environmental reporting and transparency, and has called for better corporate governance. And I encourage everybody who may have a 401k or 403b plan, any retirement plans that your family or yourself have, to make sure that that money that is yours and that's supposed to be set aside for when you retire is not being used to finance the very things that you were working so hard to stop. I'd like to end with an example of a victory in the private capital markets that I think bodes really well for the future and illustrates the power that activists have to actually use the power of Wall Street and to turn it against the forces of greed. A couple of weeks ago, you may have heard or read in the paper about a company called PetroChina. It's a Chinese state-owned oil company that wanted to partially go public and sell 15% of its stock on the New York Stock Exchange and raise $10 billion in the process. China National Petroleum Company recently made headlines because it was also a joint venture partner with Talisman Energy. And these two companies were drilling for oil in the Sudan, generating petrodollars, which helped the brutal Khartoum regime wage its bloody war against its own people. Because of U.S. sanctions against Sudan, China National Petroleum spun off a separate company, PetroChina, which then had plans to go raise money from U.S. investors in the U.S. markets. According to the prospectus, the document that prospective investors read before investing in a company, PetroChina had plans to downsize its workforce by 1 million people in the midst of China's unemployment crisis. It had grand plans to expand oil and gas exploitation in Tibet. On the environmental side, the company had set aside a tiny, paltry portion of money to deal with environmental management in a regulatory regime which would be governed and enforced by basically the owner of the company, the Chinese government itself. So the coalition of public interest groups that started banding together and working to oppose the PetroChina initial public offering grew. Unions, environmentalists, human rights activists, religious freedom supporters, Tibetan and Sudanese activists. And as it grew, the PetroChina stock started to waffle. Massive outreach to institutional investors by Tibet groups and other groups to not buy the PetroChina stock meant that CalPERS, the California Public Employees Retirement System, which basically is the retirement system that takes care of every California public employee, the largest public pension fund in the country, said no to PetroChina stock. Then came TIAA CREF. And then came Vanguard. We had members of Congress writing the Securities and Exchange Commission asking them to delay or to not allow PetroChina to be listed. When was the last time Congress tried to intervene in an IPO on Wall Street, for goodness sakes? The SEC chairman, Arthur Levitt, had his email flooded with thousands and thousands of messages from Tibet activists saying to not let the PetroChina deal go through. You can bet that Arthur Levitt hasn't had his email clogged up in quite a while. The AFL-CIO pledged that $1 trillion of working capital, of working people's capital, would not get involved with a PetroChina IPO. And in fact, they held an alternative roadshow. And a roadshow is a dog and pony show that Goldman Sachs and other underwriters of the deal shop around and try to give it a little bit of sizzle, interest institutional investors. And what happened is that AFL-CIO, on the very day Goldman Sachs was supposed to have their roadshow, booked a room in the very same hotel that they were supposed to have their schmancy lunch in, and at 10 o'clock invited people to come up to our roadshow, the coalition's roadshow, right before that. Goldman Sachs canceled the roadshow. Goldman Sachs, for the first time, had 100 protesters show up in front of their offices in downtown New York and had a banner hung from their building. I don't think that has happened in a while either. So what had happened is that a proposed $10 billion stock offering went to $8 billion, and then it went to $7, and then it went to $5, and it finally went to under $3, and then on the first day of trading, tanked. As a result, two more Chinese state-owned enterprises have, and their plans to go public in the United States have been put on ice. So what does this story tell us? It tells us that greed on Wall Street can be overcome by the social conscience and power of the people. It shows us that we can win and will continue to win. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. Our next speaker is a special guest and one whose work really needs no introduction in this group. He is, in my opinion, the premier investigative and analytical reporter in this country. He is the author of Secrets of the Temple, Who Will Tell the People, and One World Ready or Not. And I would note that as the new national affairs correspondent of The Nation magazine, the premier progressive magazine in this country, all of his articles have been on globalization. Please welcome Bill Greider.
Thanks a lot. You may recognize that I am in that group John described as us former youth. I am more former than John is, you may also see. And this week reminds me of my sweet late mother used to say in mysterious moments, life is strange, life is wonderful. And that's how you all make me feel. I have been a reporter, not an activist, for almost 40 years, believe it or not. And when I wrote the book on the global economy, I said, I've got to see this for myself, which is what a good reporter says. And so I traveled a lot on three or four continents. Unlike the pundits you read in the Washington Post or the New York Times who lecture you on how you're hurting the poor, I actually talked to workers in those factories. And I assure you that that's not how they look at it. They do not need people like you or me to tell them that they are being exploited. They know that from their own circumstances. And I could spend my time telling you the stories that are in me forever. They haunt me, in fact. I'll just tell you one. I was at an industrial zone outside Jakarta, Indonesia. And an NGO, actually a small Christian group, has a hostel there for workers in the factories that make Nike and Adidas and all the shirts and shoes and so forth. And the kids come to this hostel on Sundays, their day off, for education, but also to talk about themselves and their circumstances. And so I got to spend an afternoon with them. I can call them kids. I could be their grandfather. These sweet, primly dressed up for this strange American, I guess, kids, most of them teenagers, a few in their 20s, early 20s, most of them women, a couple of boys, are sitting around this table. And they're a little nervous in my presence and shy, and they want to be responsive, and almost all of them spoke no English, and I spoke no Bahasa, so we had an older woman translating. And it started in a very kind of tentative, stilted manner. And we talked about their lives and their jobs. And as it warmed up, it was an actual conversation, despite the language gulf. And I said, well, tell me about your wages or, you know, your feelings about your jobs. And they would be just, when they translated my words, there'd be this ripple of laughter around the table. And they would explain their disappointments. And I had gone to where some of them lived, and I could understand that, you know, the sleeping on pallets in shifts. And their wages, of course, are not living wages. And the working conditions have a kind of nastiness to them that that they didn't understand, frankly. And I would say, well, what about going back home? Because virtually all of them had come from desperate poverty. And of course they were grateful for the wage income. And I said, well, you could go home, right? And again, the laughter ran around the table this time. You can't go home again with these disappointments until you have made something yourself. And I said, well, what about unions? And most of them at the table did not know what that word meant. One young woman said, well, we have a union in our factory, but it's all of the managers or the officers of this union. And some of the others said they knew the concept, but in any case, they had had strikes. And more than one, and some of them had been fired and gotten back in the door at other factories and so forth. So the next time somebody wags a finger at you and lectures you about how you're hurting people, just say, if the poor people in these countries are so grateful to multinational corporations for these jobs, why are there so many strikes? I mean, not just hundreds. There are thousands of wildcat strikes across developing countries. We never hear about them because they're mostly small and local. And in a country like Indonesia, if it's serious enough, there will be military troops that come to the factory and suggest that the workers go back to work. I mean, I think it's so simple to us, but we have some education to do with other Americans who have been reading, after all, for years and years, that this is our beneficence to those poor people, getting them out of the villages and into the factories. And I said, I'm haunted by those experiences and also, frankly, exhilarated because what I came back from that meeting thinking, these kids ain't that different from my kids or from any of you. I mean, when you get into a real human conversation, we all have aspirations and we all have confusions and doubts and so forth. And so I get this powerful sense of the commonness of our humanity, which is what this movement is all about, absolutely. And then the long ride back to Jakarta, I found myself thinking, oh, God, these are the kids who make the shoes that go to America and have Michael Jordan leaping across basketball courts. And I love Michael Jordan, but the conflict between those two realities is really staggering. These kids are up against the enormity of power, real life, at 16 or 17, in a way that almost none of us have had to experience in our lives in this country. And they want to understand it, and they want to get voice. At the end of the meeting, they handed me this little sheet of paper, which was their petition to American students. This is 1994, I guess. And it's got 20 or 30 signatures on it, all carefully written, and they've written the name of the factory next to their names. And I can't remember the language. I've got it in my files. I didn't have the heart to tell them, Americans don't have a clue about you all. Don't have a clue. And I thought, what would those two groups say to each other if they were in the same table where I was? What would American kids say to these kids? Then I came home and wrote a book, and life went on. And a couple of years later, I woke up and realized that conversation has begun. You're making the conversation. And it really has. And you know, I could tell you 12 other stories like that, but that's the connection, and it's grounded in your humanity and your sense of responsibility as human beings, and it's in economics and a lot of other stuff. And it's hard. I mean, we ought to just be upfront with ourselves about that. I know something about politics and history, and social movements are very rare in history, not just American history, but in all nations. when people come together without a visible authority mobilizing them, without a leader, charismatic or otherwise, but simply somehow gather the way John described it, like streams. That's very rare. And it is even more rare for social movements to succeed. And you can read through American history and European history and Asian history and see that that's the case. We know that up front, and yet here we are. So don't be discouraged by that. I think us former youth have a role to play in this, which is not because we know some things and we've been places and we will happily share that information and insight with you. Not to instruct you, but simply to put some more questions in your head. And I say, I'm a reporter and I have a number of harsh critics, particularly in your universities, and I say, don't take my word for it, do your own reporting, check it out. And that's also what you all are doing. So I want to give you a few ideas about, along the lines of what you've already heard, of how to think forward. What do we do next, or what does this movement think about doing next? I've written some pieces in The Nation trying to offer some of those possibilities, and there's some of the ideas you've heard and you will hear. I had one in particular which was based on this premise. This is a peculiarly American problem because, as David said, this globalization process came out of America, fostered by the Cold War, fostered by Reconstruction after World War II, and advanced by American multinationals and American finance preeminently. And we as a nation, are the largest obstacle to reforming this system. And I think a lot of the ideas that we are talking about would find, none of them are easy, we know. They're all difficult. But they would find an audience in a lot of governments around the world, both rich and poor. And the U.S. government and the capital markets and the multinationals that embrace the U.S. government would still be standing there saying that's heresy, that's radical, blah, blah, blah. So I'm one of those who believes while we do all the other things we want to do, we should try to locate this fight in American politics as quickly as we can. One of my ideas about how to do that is a kind of model legislation to impose social and moral values on American multinationals. And I deliberately start modestly, not trying to swallow the whole cake, but to establish the principle that a national government, namely the United States, does have the sovereign power to do that. The propaganda has taught us for 20 years, A, that that's illegitimate, but B, it's impossible anyway. You can't get your hand on this system. That's, of course, false. And we want to do this in a way that really expresses our bona fides to the rest of the world, because developing countries are indeed skeptical of our intentions and our motives, and they are right to be skeptical of American motives and intentions. They've had a lot of experience with them over the years during the Cold War. So I start with simple ideas like, and here's another scene that haunts me. I was in Thailand 10 months after the worst industrial fire in the history of capitalism. I'm sure some of you know about it. Most Americans have never heard of it. It was a toy factory outside Bangkok. Huge, quick fire, big factory, 3,000 workers. 188 people were killed, most of them women, some as young as 13, 14 years old. And nearly 500 were seriously injured. And very much like the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in New York in 1911, the exits collapsed, the stairways, the women had to jump out of four-story windows, and they died or were horribly injured. America didn't hear about this factory, yet it manufactured all of the best names in American toys. Bart Simpson and the Muppets, and go down the list. So I would start with fire prevention and say, we are not going to buy toys or shirts and shoes or light appliances that are assembled in factories that you cannot certify you are using modern fire prevention techniques. Now here, I'm not leaving any room for discussion. We just won't buy them. And if you don't want to do that, fine, we'll buy toys somewhere else. There's no technological mystery here. We know how to do that. We've known how to do that for 60 or 80 years. But it establishes the principle, and the arguments, of course, will come back, well, that's intrusive. I would say, well, is it intrusive for the Federal Aviation Administration to inspect the manufacturer of commercial airliners overseas, which, of course, it does, and the maintenance shops for overseas airliners? You can't fly a commercial airliner in this country without that certification, and frankly, I wouldn't want to fly on a plane without that. So intrusion is intrusion. If we can do that to make sure we're flying safe airplanes, we can do it to protect the lives of those young workers in Asia. Oh, I hear a bell. Secondly, on the environment. It is true the U.S. nor our multinationals can set environmental standards for foreign countries. That's down the road a ways when we get the international apparatus to do that. What we can do is what we do to American companies at home, which is to require them by law to share their toxic release information with their own workers and communities, not just the governments in those offshore plants, but the people who themselves are affected, to deliver an environmental impact statement that says, we're starting this mine or this oil refinery or whatever, and this was what we think it's going to do to your environment. We can require that. Simple legislation. There's one little hook in this. We are going to certify in law what is now being argued in the courts, which is that those foreign citizens have the standing to sue those companies in U.S. federal court. And then I would do something very similar, again, not too intrusive, on labor rights and some certification from those companies. Are you following? This is simple stuff. Are you obeying the labor laws in the country where you're operating? That's a tougher question for them to answer than you imagine. China has perfectly good labor laws. So does Indonesia. So does Thailand. So go down the list. And then I would ask them to inform their leaders or their workers by posting it in translation what the core labor standards are and whether, in fact, the company is observing them in that factory. And if not, why not? And what I'm suggesting is, and I know this as a reporter, believe it or not, for all of the fancy technology and high-priced strategists in this global system, nobody in the world has an authentic map of what's going on. So let's get government to draw that map, at least, and of course, encourage other countries to do it alongside. I'm out of time. I just want to mention one other dimension of the same point. Two bells means they carry me off. The same point applies to global finance. We could shut down the offshore banking centers tomorrow, which are the conduit for hot money and dirty money. And Jim Leach, moderate Republican, chairman of the House Banking Committee, has a bill that at least begins to force them into daylight. He's fed up with this money being funneled out of Russia through islands in the Pacific and so forth, and he suggests a new regulation that says no U.S. commercial bank can accept transfers from any offshore banking center, really money shops, unless they can certify, A, that it's a real bank, it takes deposits and make loans like a normal bank, and B, that it is genuinely regulated by its host government. I urge you, first of all, to send a friendly email to Congressman Leach. He understands the global system. He knows the road he is starting down, because that opens the door to all sorts of standards And we can't do this by ourselves. We don't want to do it by ourselves. But I do think we need to establish in our politics that we're not just going to hold capital markets responsible, and we're not just going to hold multinationals responsible for these values we have. We're going to find some ways to very directly hold elected politicians responsible. Thanks.
Thank you, Bill Greider.